Great. Thank you very much for being here. I'd like to thank the organizers for putting up the conference and for giving me an opportunity to appear here. This is work done in collaboration with Lampros Lampru, Sam McCandlish, and James Sully, two of whom, Sam and James, are here to answer all your questions, surely better than I will be able to. Now, from tensor networks to holography, I'm here to tell you that the way to go from one to the other involves an additional translator, and that additional translator is the formalism of integral geometry. So let's discuss that. But as any presentation, this one also has to have a motivational part. So why do we expect there to be a relation between tensor networks and holography? Now, to answer that, a brief review of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Gifra said a lot of the things I want to say here, but let me just highlight the features that are important for my purposes. I think for those of us who are more interested in field theory than in gravity, we can think of the holographic duality as giving us an auxiliary representation of a conformal field theory, which happens to involve gravitational dynamics. And here's a picture that accompanies those words. I have a 1+1 dimensional field theory, which in this case I put on a circle cross time, so on a hollow cylinder. And there is an equivalent description of the same physics, which involves gravity, which lives in the solid cylinder that's filled in, and that's what we know as the three-dimensional anti de Sitter space. And I chose these dimensions because this is what I will be focusing on in the remainder of this talk. Now, this auxiliary representation, holographic representation of the CFT, is useful because it makes transformations, scale transformations, or RG, manifest. And in particular, it does so precisely by filling in this hollow cylinder and making up ADS space, namely by introducing an additional dimension which corresponds to the RG in the field theory. Now, let's take a step back. I'm literally taking a step back. Look at these words and notice that a lot of the same words, just except the word gravity, really apply to tensor networks. I'm going to stress this on the next slide even more, where I take a look at an equal time slice of this picture, at t equals 0 or t equals 1. So this equal time slice of the geometry, I'm drawing here for you, the spatial slice of a holographic geometry, and this is the holographic representation of a state in the conformal field theory. And like I said before, holography represents the information about the state with an additional dimension which encodes RG transformations. Now, this is exactly what we would have said about a tensor network. It also has an additional dimension which encodes, which corresponds to transformations in scale. Furthermore, if I look at how entanglement entropies are represented in the two pictures, we know, thanks to Tadashi and Shinsei Ryu, that entanglement entropies of intervals in the CFT are represented by geodesics in the bulk. In general, we use the word minimal surface, but because I'm in a 1+1 boundary setup, minimal surfaces are just minimal curves, namely geodesics. While in the Mera network, we look for a minimal cut, which is which represents the which counts for us some contributions to the entanglement entropy of an interval. So in both cases, we're looking for a minimization problem, which looks very much the same. And this parallelism is probably not an accident. So it's our duty to understand how to map one to the other. And this parallelism was first pointed out by Brian Swingle in 2009. So this is my goal, to understand the map from one to the other. And the ingredients I will use is the causal structure of Mera, which Gifra kindly agreed to review for me in his talk, and the minimal cut prescription, namely the idea that I can get an estimate of the entanglement entropy by looking at the number of cuts that I have to make in going from one endpoint to the other endpoint of a connected interval. So counting cuts is a proxy for what the entanglement entropy of this interval is. These are the ingredients I will be using. What's the strategy? The strategy is to construct some metric, a metric tensor, to construct a metric which captures just these properties of Mera, the causal structure and the minimal cut prescription. And once we construct that metric, we're going to relate that to the holographic geometry. And I'll tell you how this relation is being done. This metric under construction is what's called the kinematic metric, and it's an object which belongs to the study of integral geometry. So hence my title, integral geometry as a translator between Mera and a holographic geometry. OK, so as a first step in choosing this metric, let's take this causal structure. So whenever we have a causal structure, one thing we can do is identify null coordinates in this space. In this case, in the case at hand, Mera is a 1 plus 1 dimensional object. And so we just have a pair of null coordinates, which I called v and u for here over here. And if I take a point in Mera and I give it some set of coordinates, u and v, how do we read what those coordinates mean? Well, one thing we can do is we can drop down a minimal cut, which starts on the top, or whose tip lives exactly at this point uv. So starting from a point, I can draw a unique minimal cut, which is dropped from that point. This minimal cut selects an interval in the field theory. And the coordinates of that interval are going to be precisely the null coordinates of the point from which the interval was selected. So u and v are endpoints of an interval which just lives in the causal past of this point, but they're also the null coordinates of the point u and v. Another way to say this is that if u and v happens to contain an isometry at that point, then this is the isometry which completes the compression of the state of the interval uv. It's the final one that we have to do in order to attain the, or to select the compressed state on this subsystem. Another way to say what this causal structure is that, so this choice of v and u, the choice of these null coordinates, immediately tells me that if there is a metric to speak of, then this metric has to take this form, du times dv, times some function, which in general will be a function of u and v. But if I'm going to have this structure, the metric has to come in this fashion. Now, I noticed that a few of the other speakers made the remarks that if you're not familiar with the use of metrics, then don't worry about it. Unfortunately, I cannot say that this metric is important, but maybe it's useful to say just a few words about how to read the metric or what this means for those of us who are not, who don't use work with metrics day to day. So if I'm traveling along a null ray, that means that, let's say, in this direction, that means that I'm undergoing a change in v, but I have zero change in u. So if I plug in that change in v and that zero change in u into this formula for distance, I will get zero. So this metric automatically guarantees for me that if I'm traveling in a null direction, I'm undergoing or I'm incurring zero displacement. Okay. Now, why is the metric Lorentzian? I just told you how the that the metric has to have this form because of this, the causal structure. But what is an intuitive meaning for what this causal structure is? Well, again, let's take a reference point u and v and drop down a minimal cut from that point and select an interval. And then let's think about how other points can be related to that reference point. Well, there are at least two qualitatively different ways that another chosen point can be related to this one. One way is this one, and I will call this case time-like. That's a case, the red case, where the interval, the point u and v, selects an interval which is entirely contained in my reference interval. That's one possible qualitative separation of this pair of points. Another qualitatively different way of relating a pair of points is this one, the green one and the blue one. Now, they are not, neither interval contains the other, and I'm going to call this type of separation space-like. The fact that points can be related to one another in two qualitatively different ways automatically tells me that if there is going to be a metric which captures the structure of Mera, it has to be Lorentzian. And that's the metric that we wrote down on the, that we have over here. What is the crossover between time-like and space-like separation? Well, let's fix one of these coordinates, let's say u, and just vary v. So I don't have an animation for this, but imagine that I'm making this v, this red interval, larger and larger by extending it to the right, yes? At which point am I going to cross over from the time-like to the space-like separation? Of course, it's going to happen when this red v just catches up with the blue v. Once it goes over to the other side, I'm going to go to the space-like separation. So this tells me that a condition for null separation, the crossover between space-like and time-like regimes, is when the v is equal. And I could make the same argument for u's. This is the reason why u and v are good null coordinates on this space. In other words, the past of a given point in this language consists of those intervals which are entirely contained in my interval, and the future consists of those intervals which entirely contain my interval, which themselves contain it. And the space-like separated intervals are those which are neither past nor future. OK, so this is the comments that I have to make for, that I had to make for fixing the causal structure of this metric. Now we just have to choose the conformal factor, the factor in front, which measures little volumes in, of regions with null boundaries in this metric. So how are we going to do that? For this, I invite you to consider the quantity called conditional mutual information. Here is the definition of a conditional mutual information. And specifically, I would like you to consider the conditional mutual information of three neighboring intervals, in this case, A, B, and C. So for those of you who, comment that is in order here is that this is exactly the quantity which shows up on the left-hand side of the strong subadditivity inequality. So strong subadditivity is precisely the statement that these conditional mutual informations are never negative. Now, how is this quantity represented in MERA? I told you that I will use two assumptions. One was the causal structure, and the other one was the minimal cut prescription. So let's draw the minimal cuts that correspond to these four entanglement entropies. The positive terms, the purple ones, I marked here with purple cuts. And then the negative terms, the orange ones, I marked with orange cuts. And we see that there are a lot of cancellations. There is a cancellation here, 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 and there. And the only term which does not end up being canceled out, the only term that gives me a net contribution to the conditional mutual information, comes from this region over here, which got shaded. That's the place where the cuts did not pairwise cancel one another out. What is the number in units of, I guess, bond dimension that quantifies this conditional mutual information? Well, in this case, it is the number of cuts which count with the positive, a positive sign, minus the ones that count with a negative sign. So that's one cut here and one cut here, minus one cut here over at the top. So I have a net contribution of one for the conditional mutual information. And let me ask you this question: why did I get one and not two or some other number? Well, it's because there was a single isometry living over here. That isometry soaked up one of the lines that came from the bottom and spat out one fewer lines coming out to the top, so giving me a net one contribution to this quantity. In other words, what conditional mutual informations are always the numbers of, or every conditional mutual information for neighboring intervals is always the number of isometries that lives in a region of this type. Now we have a very neat interpretation of what strong subadditivity was. This quantity was supposed to be non-negative, and it's just giving us the statement that we never have a negative number of triangles in the network. Are there any questions? So why am I talking about conditional mutual informations? So far, I promised that my strategy was going to be select a metric, and so far we got this far, but we have to choose a correct volume form. So this was to motivate a choice of a volume form. Here's an idea: let volume count isometries. So I'm going to take this little region in kinematic space, and I'm going to assign a volume 1 to this region because there is a single isometry here. So that isometry gives me a number 1 to the correct conditional mutual information that's selected by this region in kinematic space. In particular, if I want to promote the number of isometries to give me a notion of a metric, I have to think of the coordinates of these points over here as being, say, u and v for this point. But then I'd like to think of this region in kinematic space, for the metric I'm constructing, to be given to have one null width du and the other null width dv. And so these points over here have coordinates u and v, and then u minus du and v plus dv. Yes. If I do this and plug in the entropies that appear in this formula, I discover that the conditional mutual information, when the endpoints of the intervals are coordinatized in this fashion, is nothing other than the second partial derivative of the entanglement entropy with respect to u and v. And this is the quantity which I say I'm going to promote to be my volume form in this metric under construction. So here is the metric that I wanted to construct a kinematic metric. It's the metric that encodes all the properties of Mera in a correct fashion. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah. So this conditional mutual information is always an integer.
Oh well, we're obviously working in so like I said, I'm trying to define a metric which will faithfully represent properties of Mera. If I'm working in a discrete geometry such as Mera, then I would just have a discrete set of distances in this, or a discrete metric set of distances. But I want to also be bold and extrapolate to some continuous limit, which I'm envisioning taking later.
Yeah, I'm surprised even that at the level of discrete lattice that this entropic quantity is always an integer.
Oh well, so this is a good. So this is a question about the validity of the minimal cut prescription, and maybe I'll make some comments at this towards the end. But this is ultimately the question: can we really count the number of cuts if we want to estimate entanglement entropies? And it's a very valid question for sure. Yeah. Oh, the isometries are the triangles in the network. And so this is the, these are those tensors in Mera which have two lines coming from the bottom and one line leaving at the top. So the isometries are just the triangles in the network, and the free-noded, sorry, the free-legged tensors which Giffre discussed in his talk. We just give a name, isometry, to that type of tensor in the network.
Okay. Another question, which is in the Hedrick proof of strong subactivity, the things you paste together aren't actually the minimum area things. So you have to find a different one that's the true minimum. Are you saying in the mirror network that's not the case, that you can just...
Well, I guess this is what I'm saying, that if we follow the minimal cut prescription naively, then I just get these cancellations. It's true that in the bulk, this is part of the reason why integral geometry is a useful concept, because it allows us to localize conditional mutual informations. In the Hedrick proof of strong subadditivity, I would have a different purple cut or a different purple geodesic, which wouldn't follow the orange geodesics, yes? It's the fact of Mera that that these minimal cuts are precisely coincident in this fashion. That's really the point, and that's not a discretization artifact. It's just this is how those cuts work. Yeah.
I thought when Giffre's talk that the minimal cut only gave you a bound entanglement that Giffre thinks.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, so I'm so like I said, I started with the assumption that I'm going to take the minimal cut to be the number of to give me an estimate of the entanglement entropy. The reason why I have some confidence in that is that the number of cuts I'm making for any interval goes logarithmically with the size of the interval, and that's the correct scaling for the entanglement entropy. So there's some merit to making this estimate. There's also a hope that this bound is going to be saturated in the large N limit. So these are some of the words that I want to give as commentary at this point.
But
and let's.
Oh,
sorry, can you say again?
Any entropy will scale with the same logarithm with a different coefficient. So how do you know that this is the right answer?
So again, I'm going. One of the questions that I'm going to have at the end is going to be an open question. Can we deduce from the large N limit that this bound is saturated? I will be posing that question towards the end. So let me leave this as an open question within the confines of this talk. In the paper that Jamie, Sam, and Lampros are writing, we're going to address that issue to some degree, but it goes beyond the scope of the talk today. Yeah.
This is always 0 or 1.
Oh, what is? What is always 1 and 0?
Your definition of the
bi. Oh, well, it's 1 in this case because I chose...
I got it. Yeah. Never greater than 1?
Well, of course, this is going to happen on the next slide. So let me just talk about the next slide. Actually, this slide here is going to answer that question. So can you hold on with that question for just 2 slides? Okay. Good. So what I've motivated for you so far is a structure of this space, the kinematic space which is under construction, which is like which can be summarized like this. Whenever I have a rectangle which has null boundaries or null sides, I'm going to associate it with some conditional mutual information, like so. And a special okay. And what is it? Which free intervals enter the, this conditional mutual information? There is the interval A, which I can follow down along null lines, and define with respect to this rectangle. There is also C, which I select in the same fashion. And then what I'm conditioning on in my conditional mutual information lives directly in the past of the bottom point of this rectangle. Now, I've been using the word rectangle, but this is an awkward word. Instead, I should say causal diamond, because these are nothing but causal diamonds in our causal structure of Mera. A special case of the assignment or of the identification of causal diamonds and conditional mutual information is if the set B is empty. And this is what we have in these causal diamonds. The causal diamonds that reach all the way down to the bottom of Mera have nothing living in their causal past. So this is a conditional mutual information where I'm conditioning on nothing. It's just conditional, sorry, it's just mutual information, period. I can also make a similar comment about the content of these regions, so past causal cones of regions in the bulk of kinematic space. And what they are the number of isometries that live here characterize the isometric embedding on the state that lives here into a local basis for the A interval or the B interval, as the case may be. And so the number of isometries here tell me by how much I'm embedding my state into a larger Hilbert space, or what else I'm mixing in that embedding. Now, this assignment is only or can only be consistent if the following is true. Let me take a causal diamond and split it up into two smaller causal diamonds. And this goes back to David's question. Do I always have one isometry in every region, or can I have two? So here is a causal diamond which contains two isometries, this one over here and that one over there. And if I'm going to say that every conditional mutual and for every causal diamond computes some conditional mutual information, well, then here's what I have to satisfy. I have this causal diamond split up into two smaller causal diamonds. Each one of them has an interpretation as a conditional mutual information. So it had better be the case that when I add them together, I get this larger conditional mutual information for A, B, and D given C. And is it true? The answer is yes. It's an identity which follows from the definition of conditional mutual information, and it's what we call the chain rule for conditional mutual information. So in retrospect, when we look at this chain rule, at the formula for conditional mutual information, it was really asking us to make an identification of itself with a geodesic or with a geometric object of this form. Good. So these are the comments about kinematic space, how we construct it. And now let's talk about the translation of that into a holographic geometry. So here I have a summary of what we've learned so far. I tried to define a metric which would have all the right properties, but obviously be a continuous metric, which would have all the right properties that are in correspondence with the salient features of Mera. And in particular, when I give a point here, or when I describe a point with a choice of null coordinates u and v, then this u and v uniquely, or this choice of point uniquely selects a minimal cut which can be dropped down from it, and also a boundary interval which lives in its causal past. And now, suppose that the state has a holographic description that obeys the Ryuta-Kayanagi proposal. How am I going to make a translation from here into the geometry that we know and love? And so here is the statement. This point u and v selects a specific minimal cut, so a specific entanglement entropy, and it also selects a specific interval on the boundary. So a point in this space selects a boundary interval. It also selects a geodesic, but it would be a lie to say that it just selects a geodesic. It selects a geodesic with an orientation, because if I just gave you this geodesic, you wouldn't know if the interval being selected is this one or the complement, yes? So it gives me an oriented geodesic. And yes, that's the correspondence. And so here is the statement. The kinematic space we just constructed is the space of oriented geodesics, or equivalently, it is the space of boundary intervals. Are there any questions about that? OK. So So let's see how this how kinematic space encodes objects which are familiar to us from the geometric language. And I think the most basic object that everybody likes in a geometry is the concept of a curve. So I drew a curve for you here. It's a closed curve. And I'd like to understand how it's encoded in kinematic space. So as a first step, what I'm going to do is draw a bunch of geodesics which intersect that curve. Why am I drawing geodesics? Because points in kinematic space are geodesics. So by selecting these geodesics, I'm also selecting a bunch of points over here. Is that clear? Now, why do I have two families of points? There's a family here, which may or may not show, and a family here in the center. That's because every geodesic comes with an orientation. So when I draw a geodesic once, I'm really selecting a pair of points here, one from here and one from there, yes? And I drew here a set of geodesics which have a common axis, if you like. But of course, I could have done this for another axis, and this also draws for me a selection of points, and likewise for another axis and for another axis. When I draw them all together, I get a picture of this type, and this is just some set of points which live in kinematic space. But I only did this for discrete axes. Now let me ask the question, what is the set of all geodesics which intersect the curve? Well, the answer is this. I can't draw it on this side, but over here I can draw it as a sequence, as a region over here. And what we're learning is that a convex curve in here corresponds to or translates into some region in kinematic space. Now, what can we make out of this correspondence between curves and kinematic regions? Well, there is a quantitative formula which translates from one to the other. It turns out that the circumference of the curve in correct units, the same units that Ryu and Takayanagi use, equals this integral. It's possible to prove this equality. And what this is nothing but the volume in kinematic space under the metric that we have selected. So in retrospect, what we were really doing is engineering a metric for which this quantity would be the volume form. And the region over which I'm performing this integral in kinematic space is that region which corresponds to geodesics that intersect my curve. It consists of geodesics intersecting my curve. That's why I have this intersect here. In retrospect, notice that this formula tells me that the length of any, at least convex curve, is essentially a sum or an integral over a bunch of conditional mutual informations. And going back to Mera, or making a connection with Mera, what this counts is the number of isometries. And so the length of a curve is nothing but the number of isometries. On the previous slide, we went from a curve to a region in kinematic space. But the title was From Tensor Networks to Holography. So this is sort of backwards relative to the title of the talk. So how do I characterize a curve given a region? Well, the region over here consists of geodesics that that intersect my curve. I hope you see what I mean by this cartoonish equation. The boundary of intersection is tangency. In other words, if I take the set which consists of intersecting geodesics, what sits on the boundary is the tangent geodesics. And so these guys over here are precisely the geodesics that are tangent to my curve, and that's what I drew over here. That tangency line, or that border line, is some function v of u in these coordinates, and the way that I interpret this v of u is that if I have a geodesic which is tangent to my curve, then one endpoint lives at u, and the other one lives at the function v of u. This is the meaning of this function over here. Now, using this coordinatization, I can actually compute the integral over here. And when I compute it, I get a formula like this. And those of us who follow this development will recognize this as the differential entropy formula. It is the formula for the length of this curve. And so we know that the identification we have done is consistent and correct. And in particular, it's consistent and correct for every geometry that obeys the Ryu-Takayanagi proposal. I did not assume that I was in the vacuum or in the thermal state or something else. Anything that obeys the Ryu-Takayanagi formula is going to satisfy this relation. OK, now here's a little. Yes? It's true for a class of curves. It's true that there is a class of geometries for which I can select a class of curves for which I will not have this interpretation.
What's in every geometry?
Yeah, that formula works in every geometry. I didn't say for every curve. Okay. We don't want, so what Mukund is referring to is the minimality condition. If I'm going to have if I want to relate this a curve to a tangent geodesic, I don't have a guarantee that this tangent geodesic is going to be minimal. And I only can associate a geodesic to an entanglement entropy if it happens to be minimal. This is really the caveat that Mukund is, So this is some terrifying news because I'm learning that I have 55 seconds left now. I think I'm going to skip this slide, which is a shame, discuss. Oh, but this is neat. So I said that the length of a curve is given by the volume of the intersecting geodesics. What are the geodesics that intersect a geodesic? Is a question that you can ask. And the answer is that it's those that have one endpoint inside the interval and the other one outside the interval that the geodesic spans. This corresponds to just this set of large causal diamonds in kinematic space. Well, now I can contrast this with some curve which is not a geodesic itself, yes? Now, there are obviously more geodesics that intersect the yellow curve than the orange curve, yes? For example, there is this set of geodesics which only intersect the yellow but not the orange. That means that the volume in kinematic space that corresponds to the yellow curve is going to be larger than the volume corresponding to the orange curve, and that's just the statement that the yellow curve is longer. Orange is geodesic, yellow is not. So we can now ask, what are these geodesics that intersect the yellow but not the orange? And it's some region over here. And the statement is that if I go back to Mera and think about what this means, this region is populated by some number of isometries, and this number of isometries is precisely the difference between the length of the yellow and the orange curve. So those extra isometries quantify the isometric embedding of the state from here to there, and that's the state on the orange line going to the state of the on the yellow line. So difference is length, and length is the number of isometries in an isometric embedding of states. And I think I have zero time left. I will say one thing, though, which is that let me give you a specific example of kinematic space. Because I have to define it for every state separately, a new state is going to have a new set of entanglement entropies. What is it for the vacuum? And the answer is, when I plug in the entanglement entropy for the vacuum into my formula, I will get a metric of this type under some change of coordinates, and that's nothing but the de Sitter geometry. So what we're learning is that the de Sitter, two-dimensional de Sitter, is the kinematic space for the vacuum. Why? Well, to understand this, I have to go back to the hyperboloid model of the hyperbolic space, which is the spatial slice of ADS-free. A geodesic over here is given by a geodesic in hyperbolic space is given by the intersection of the hyperboloid with a plane, and that plane has a normal. That normal selects a single point on the other hyperboloid, which has the opposite sign on the right-hand side. And that other hyperboloid is the de Sitter geometry. So this is the reason why we see an explicit geometric reason for why the space of geodesics on the hyperbolic plane is the two-dimensional de Sitter geometry. And this connection with reference to Mera was first pointed out by Cedric Benny in 2011. I found this neat quote in his paper as I was preparing for the talk. Here's a summary. I sketched a quantitative connection between tensor networks and the holographic geometry. I explained how it is mediated by integral geometry. I used the assumptions of Ryota Kayanagi proposal, which gives me confidence that this goes beyond the vacuum on the thermal state. And on the tensor network side, I used this this identification, which we had some questions about. And I'd like to pose a question for all of us. Does holography imply that we can construct a Mera-like tensor network with this property, mimicking a metric of kinematic space? Some future questions are here for us to behold. I will go back to this slide, but before that, here's the thank you slide. Thank you very much.
Questions?
I have a question. Do you really expect that you can
I mean, so if you're given, say, the Ryu-Takinagi entropies, which give you some spectrum of lengths of curves in the bulk, then I don't think we expect that generically you could reconstruct a metric from that, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So this is a well-studied problem, which has no general definite answers, but it has some number of definite answers.
I mean, I think we know, for example, if you consider three manifolds that solve Einstein's equations, you can find examples that are isospectral but not isometric.
So this is this problem, if someone here is looking to Google up the answer to this question, this problem is known as boundary rigidity. And the answer is that for a class of manifolds in two dimensions, a large class of manifolds in two dimensions are boundary rigid. Namely, if you give me the distance function for boundary points, then you can uniquely reconstruct a Riemannian metric for such a such a geometry.
But constant negative curvature metrics are not in that class, though, right?
It's negative curvature helps you. It's positive curvature that doesn't.
Nope.
Because what the
Sure.
So the obstacle to reconstructing that metric in generality is conjugate points. And conjugate points tend to appear when I have positive curvature. For example, on a sphere, the North Pole and the South Pole are conjugate points. And so I'm not going to be able to define to select a unique metric for that reason, for any geometry that has a local positive curvature bump. But if I have negative curvature, then I can do it assuming the absence of conjugate points.
Okay, but if you have non-trivial topology, I think at genus 5, there are examples of Riemann surfaces with boundaries.
Oh, yes, that's true. Another assumption on this in this theorem is that the manifold be topologically trivial.
Right.
In the presence of more boundaries, the issue becomes more complicated.
It might work better in Lorentzian signature than in Euclidean signature.
But here I'm reconstructing the metric I'm implicitly reconstructing the metric for a Euclidean geometry in the bulk of ADS. Of course, I gave you this metric for kinematic space, but the hope is that they contain equivalent information. So.
Thank you.
Formula, because you could have a large and free theory for which there is no such thing.
No, for the so I.
What are the assumptions that go into this game?
Okay, I constructed kinematic space without having to talk about large N at all, and in fact without having to talk about tensor networks or anything like that. I just gave you a metric which is given in terms of entanglement entropies Formally speaking, I can write down this metric for any state in the field theory. The question is, does it have a geometric interpret? Does it translate into an object in geometry? And it will translate to some object in geometry, so long as the entanglement entropy of an interval in the field theory is given by some functional which I have to extremize in the bulk of some of the geometry under construction. If that functional is length, then this is what I was talking about today. I could consider situations when it's not length, but some corrected formula, which generalizes Ryu-Takayanagi, and then I would have a similar set of statements, but those statements wouldn't be about curves. It would be about objects which have some integral of the quantity which computes entanglement entropy. Now, where did I need large N? I principally invoked it in this talk in saying that trying to move towards a connection with tensor networks. So as Aaron's question or maybe other people's questions pointed out, I need to have in order to make a connection with tensor networks, I wanted to have a minimal cut prescription for counting entropies. And the hope is that large N is going to, if I constructed MERA for a large N CFT, if we imagine doing so, then the hope is that the cuts are really going to contribute proportionally to the computation of entanglement entropy. But that reference to large N was completely independent of the construction of kinematic space. It was just to motivate the connection of tensor networks.
Any more? Okay, last question. just wanted to ask briefly, does it seem like this will generalize the higher dimensions?
Oh, yeah. Oh, great. Thank you very much. I swear that this was not staged, but I have a slide about it, which I had to skip because of time. And so in one plus one dimension, so for a one plus one dimensional CFT, we have this very simple relation between pairs of points. And points, in particular, are minimal cuts or intervals. That's, so a point defines for me the most general connected set that I can have in a one-dimensional CFT. But in higher dimensions, I have shapes, yes? And so what are we going to do? We could try to say kinematic space is going to be the space of regions in the CFT. This would be an infinite dimensional space for this reason. So probably I don't want to do that. It's a subject for a lengthy conversation to discuss what options we have in generalizing to higher dimensions. There's no way that I can give justice to it within the confines of time. But yeah, it's a very good question, and we've been thinking about it. And it's not easy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.